Deadly Voices, The True Story of Serial Killer Herbert Mullen, written by C.L. Swinney, R.J. Parker, narrated by Don Klein. Paranoid Schizophrenia. A type of schizophrenia is characterized by delusions of grandeur, paranoia, hallucinations, jealousy, hostility, aggressiveness, unfocused anxiety, argumentativeness, and, in severe cases, detachment from reality to the point of autism. My greatest fear is this brain of mine. The worst thing imaginable is to be terrified of one's own mind, the very matter that controls all that we are and all that we do and feel. Anonymous schizophrenia sufferer. I believe that my father has been unequally blamed for my failures, but surely, if he had given me the 6-year-old homosexual blowjob oral stimulation that I was entitled to, like most other people get, I would never have had taken LSD without his permission. Herbert Mullen, after his arrest on February 13, 1973. If I was allowed to go into the Coast Guard or the Marine Corps, I would not have taken all those people's lives. Herb Mullen, 1973. Make no mistake, Mr. Mullen hears voices, and the voices told him to kill. The acts were not acts of murder, but acts of sacrifice. James Jackson, Herbert Mullen's attorney at a pretrial conference. Prologue. Santa Cruz, California, June 17, 1965. 17-year-old Dean Richardson, a recent San Lorenzo Valley High School graduate, meandered along the back streets of Felton in his vehicle, combing the hills just east of Santa Cruz, contemplating what his next adventure in life would be. Those who knew him the best said he was a handsome young man with a charming attitude. It was assumed that he would do something great in the years to come. Dean took to the local airwaves to hear rock and roll and likely enjoyed the hundreds of thoughts that raced through his mind, the kind every other 17-year-old normally has. My mind paints a picture of Dean driving aimlessly, trying to hit the high notes from one of his favorite songs. Then, all at once, his life changed and tragedy struck. Suddenly, Dean lost control of his vehicle, slammed on the brakes, and spun the steering wheel trying to regain control. In doing so, he overcompensated for the spin, forcing the rear end to lose traction. The vehicle then spun to the left slightly until force and gravity caught up, causing the tires to grab the pavement solidly and flip the vehicle over. Based on the remote location, more than 20 minutes would pass before the wreck was discovered by a passerby. Sadly, Dean Robertson did not survive the crash. Dean's untimely death completely destroyed everyone who knew him. Shock reverberated through the community, and no one could believe Dean was gone. It happened so fast to a good kid who had his whole life ahead of him. But the damage, already unbearable, somehow managed to get even worse in the coming months. Herbert William Mullen, Dean's closest friend, took the news of Dean's death so drastically that he completely lost his ability to make sound decisions and mentally snapped. Demons, the devil, God, and 1,000 other voices chattered in his head, igniting and releasing a repressed mental health illness, schizophrenia, within Herbert that completely consumed him. Shortly after the accident, Herb began building several shrines to Dean in his bedroom. He'd end up sitting in front of the shrines and staring at them for hours, sometimes days at a time. He refused to let his parents into his bedroom, and his behavior suggested that something terrible had happened to their son. Obviously, his parents, who he lived with his whole life, knew Herbert well enough and were caught completely off guard by the shrines he built for Dean and the odd behavior that followed. Both parents tried to give him space since they knew he'd been crushed when his best friend died. Voices stirred in Herbert's head, and his grief resulting from Dean's death unlocked something he, and many other families, would never recover from. His choices would get progressively dangerous as the illness, coupled with illicit drug use, drove him to the brink of insanity. Ultimately, Herbert, the young man voted in high school as the most likely to succeed, would end up becoming a serial killer. He'd leave unbelievable death and destruction in small communities near Santa Cruz, California, and did so without the police having any idea it was him. Chapter 1. Salinas, California, April 18, 1947. A male child is born to Martin William Bill Mullen, a World War II hero, and his wife Jean Mullen, in the quaint farming community of Salinas, California. His parents named him Herbert William Mullen, and he was the younger of their two children. Their daughter, Patricia Mullen, had been born 3 years prior. This date, Herb's birthday, became quite significant in his life. It marked the anniversary of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and the day Albert Einstein passed away. We'll dive into this connection further along in the story. Time had healed most wounds regarding the earthquake and Albert Einstein's passing, but the pain, both physical and mental, had just begun for Herbert Mullen and his eventual victims. In 1952, when Herbert was 5 years old, the family moved north to the outskirts of San Francisco in another farming area. Herbert enjoyed a normal life, and although his mother was overly religious, Catholic, there were no indications that he struggled too much with the strict rules of the home. His father tolerated the heavy references to church and required the children to listen to their mother and not complain about going to Mass. The home life clearly left little wiggle room for Herbert or his older sister to test their parents. But, by all accounts, the kids were not physically, verbally, or sexually abused by either parent ever. Herbert attended school, received good grades, and as he got older, demonstrated fairly decent athletic ability. He enjoyed playing sports, particularly football, and had plenty of friends. The Mullen family remained near San Francisco for several years. His father sold furniture and developed a strong customer base because he was kind and fair. Around the time Herbert turned 15, his parents decided to follow their dreams and move back to the coast. They didn't have a place of their own yet, but they wanted to be along the ocean and live closer to friends and family. The family moved to Herb's aunt and uncle's cabin in Boulder Creek, until his parents could find the family a new home. Within a few weeks, his parents agreed on a modest home surrounded by trees in Felton, just outside of Santa Cruz. Mr. and Mrs. Mullen fell in love with the home and imagined it'd be there when they would live after they retired. Shortly before moving in, Herbert's parents enrolled their son into San Lorenzo Valley High School. The transition proved easy for Herbert, surprising, because his parents thought changing schools and leaving the area he called home for many years would be a challenge. On the contrary, he made numerous friends, and many of the kids found his personality and sense of humor desirable, making him quite popular. While at the school, Herbert tried out for the football team and made the varsity squad. He possessed natural talent, and the football coaches were extremely impressed with the new kid. Many years later, Herbert would reflect on his time at the high school. He would recall that the time he spent playing football set him at ease and made him happy. He played on the team with a boy his age named Dean Richardson. They became inseparable, as close as two buddies could be, to the point people used to tease them about being brothers. The popularity he gained made it easy for him to meet people, especially girls. He met a local girl named Loretta, and they became boyfriend and girlfriend after knowing each other a few weeks. Herbert would remain with Loretta throughout high school. At the end of their senior year, he was voted most likely to succeed. As far as his childhood went, Herbert appeared to be the classic all-American kid. In the summer after his high school graduation, tragedy struck Herbert. His best and closest friend, Dean Richardson, crashed his vehicle and died. The terrible news reached Herbert and smacked his psyche like a wrecking ball. From the moment he heard the terrible news, Herbert Mullen would never be the same. Dean's passing triggered a response in his mind that would lead him to become one of California's most terrifying serial spree killers. A few days after the realization his best friend was gone, Herbert began behaving strangely. He built massive shrines in his bedroom, complete with pictures, trinkets, and anything else related to Dean. He became reclusive and did not speak to many people after Dean's death. The concept of reincarnation, new to him until Dean's passing, became the only thing Herbert would think of. Some who knew him said he appeared almost possessed with the concept, and often spoke of the fact that he, or someone else, would be able to bring Dean back from the death. These thoughts were dismissed as grief instead of indicators that Herbert had begun to lose his mind. Herbert broke up with Loretta after Dean's death. He explained to her the breakup was due to the fact that he was homosexual. He told her he'd had homosexual feelings for many years, but never told anyone else about them. Loretta, confused and hurt, gave him space because she knew Dean's death had changed her lover. In the fall of 1965, after months of grieving for the loss of his best friend, Herbert appeared to take a step towards recovery by enrolling at Cabrillo College. He took courses in engineering, and at least on the surface, and to the delight of his mother, it appeared her son finally began to move on. She and her husband had been worried about him, but they gave him space and hoped that one day he'd go back to being the son they remembered. While picking up the pieces of his shattered life and slowly moving forward towards complete recovery from the loss of his best friend, Herbert ran to one of Dean's friends, James Jim Gianera. Gianera smoked marijuana quite often and convinced Herbert to try marijuana. It appeared to be a harmless gesture, but years later, Herbert would state that the marijuana messed up his brain, and he blamed Gianera for some of the horrific decisions he made later. This bit of information, the negative contact with James, would fester in Herbert's thoughts for 7 years, until revealing an ugly side of him those who knew him didn't think possible. In June of 1966, Herb completed his first year of junior college. Eventually, he looked for and gained employment with the Santa Cruz County Roads Department. The job challenged him physically and paid decently. He'd gotten back together with Loretta during college, but for an unknown reason, once he began working for the county, he left her again. This breakup would last 6 months and seemed to bother Herbert, but he was the one who chose to leave Loretta again. She wanted to be with him, but again, as she had done previously, she gave Herb room. According to records and statements made by Herbert many years later, while being interviewed by doctors and psychologists, he tried the volatile psychedelic narcotic known as LSD for the first time in October of 1966. The narcotic certainly crossed his wires and had an extremely adverse effect on the way he thought and acted. His experimentation with narcotics would increase after using LSD the first time. The drug contributed heavily towards who he'd become. In January of 1967, Herbert reached out to Loretta and they got back together again. Their relationship blossomed, and shortly after their reunion, Herbert proposed to her. Although hesitant, he was her high school sweetheart, and she loved him. So, she said yes. It seemed, at least on the surface, that Herbert had gained control of his life. He talked about starting a family with Loretta, and following in his father's steps. At one point, he mentioned joining the military. However, despite the urging of Loretta, Herbert, who'd stopped for several months, began smoking marijuana and using LSD again. He told her that he'd stopped, but she caught him licking LSD tabs and questioned him. While under the influence of these drugs, he developed a strong interest in Eastern religions. Oftentimes, he'd forego his college studies and read book after book about religious practices and beliefs, specifically those related to Hinduism. Loretta tried desperately to get Herb to stop using drugs, but he was addicted and enjoyed how they made him feel. In the summer of 1967, Herb successfully completed a 2-year degree in engineering and enrolled at San Jose State University. Still interested in engineering, he enrolled in courses he felt would line him up with a decent job once he graduated. However, the rocky relationship he developed with his parents, most notably with his father, began to take a toll on their relationship. He would often smoke marijuana to help calm his emotions after a fight with his parents, but he did so secretly so he wouldn't upset Loretta. Herbert would later become active against the war in Vietnam and told his parents he wanted to register as a conscientious objector. He later told various people who interviewed him after his apprehension, and even prior to then, that he opposed the war simply to upset his father. Almost overnight, Herbert changed his college major to philosophy and transformed his appearance and thoughts to become a hippie. Again, he later stated he did the transformation and changed his college major to get back at his parents, for raising him in such a strict environment. Herb's changes in school studies, beliefs about the war, and to his appearance, should have caused suspicion by his parents, but they left him alone. November of 1967 marked Herbert's greatest act of defiance. He dropped out of college and registered as a conscientious objector. Strangely enough, during the same time period, Herbert experienced his first sexual interaction with another male. His sexual experimentation with men went on for a few months, causing him to break off the engagement with Loretta. She didn't protest the breakup, however, because Herbert had been more angry towards her and violent towards others. In addition, he openly told people that he was bisexual, and during that time, the 1960s, his proclamation ruffled many feathers. Loretta felt their relationship had no future and blamed it on the fact that Herbert used drugs. In April of 1968, just before his 21st birthday, a local officer contacted Herbert and found him to be in possession of marijuana. The officer arrested him and took him to jail, where he was later released. A court date had been set, which Herbert attended, and he pled guilty to a lesser offense. His sentence involved being placed on probation, something he did not enjoy. The incident marked his first interaction with law enforcement and the judicial system, and he wasn't quite sure what to think about all of it. He commented later in life that his trouble with the law must have made his parents disappointed, and he had no problem disappointing them. It seemed, as the months wore on, further friction developed between him and his parents. Stumbling along looking for his own true identity, Herbert applied for a job with Goodwill Industries in San Luis Obispo and got hired. The organization had several stores in the area, and Herbert was hired to manage one of them. Management staff from Goodwill Industries said he had talent and demonstrated excellent communication skills with the people he served. While managing the store, Herbert attempted to mend his relationship with his parents, especially his father, and seemed more focused than ever to live a normal life. Herbert still wanted to be an objector to the war and asked his father if he'd write a letter to the government saying how peaceful he'd been the last few years. His conscientious objector status was granted after his letter and his father's letter were considered. However, he was required to perform alternative service to the country. Interestingly enough, the Selective Service Board credited Herbert's time employed by Goodwill Industries towards his required alternative service to the country. In February of 1969, as things seemed to be going quite smoothly, Herbert abruptly quit his job and told his parents he planned to move to India to study yoga. Of course, his parents did not approve of the change, but they ultimately had no say or control in Herbert's life. Instead of going to India, though, Herbert ended up moving to Sebastopol, California. He lived in a single-wide trailer with his sister and her husband, Albert Baca's ranch. Within a month's time, Patricia, his older sister, suspected Herbert of using drugs in the trailer. One night, while the family had dinner, Herbert began imitating his brother-in-law's every move. This activity, known as echopraxia, is a strong indication of schizophrenia. Patricia and Albert were stunned, scared, and concerned. Patricia later stated, "When my husband would eat, Herb would eat. Whatever my husband would do, Herb would do, and that went on for 4 hours. Then he just sat and stared at us." They were able to convince Herbert to voluntarily commit himself to the Mendocino State Hospital. He stayed for 6 weeks, far longer than his family had anticipated. While there, he was diagnosed as having schizophrenia, aggravated by drug use. The staff then concluded that his LSD use and other serious drug use had caused him to hear voices and become delusional. Herbert began treatment with antipsychotic medication, but as he did not agree with their assessment of him, he did not follow their advice, and he became argumentative with staff. On May 9, 1969, he checked himself out of the program and left the facility. He had not controlled the schizophrenia, and it would turn out to be a significant mistake. Every doctor and psychiatrist at the facility gave Herbert an extremely poor prognosis. Herbert later asked his sister to have sex with him, and when she declined, he asked if his brother-in-law would sleep with him. This behavior led his family to believe he'd started to use drugs again. They had no idea how terrible he'd become without getting help for schizophrenia. His family wanted to help him, but they were unsure what, if anything, could be done. In the summer of 1969, Herbert and a friend he met at the program moved to the Lake Tahoe, California area. Together, they bounced around from place to place, and Herbert eventually landed a dishwashing job at Harvey's Wagon Wheel, now Harvey's Lake Tahoe, a casino along the south shore of Lake Tahoe. He tried to make ends meet and deal with the voices in his head. He did not take medication, and he did not seek help. 2 months later, he quit the dishwashing job and moved back home with his parents. He did not have a job, and he did not enroll in college. One constant in his life was his love for the outdoors. He'd spend hours walking along trails, exploring the hills. Toward the end of summer, a forest ranger contacted him when he found Herbert on protected land. Herbert pulled a knife on the ranger, but he didn't attack him and gave up right away. Still, he was taken to the county jail, but later released at the scene instead of being booked. As we move along in this case, we shall see how fortunate the ranger had been that Herbert, and the chaotic voices growing louder in his head, allowed him to live. The contact with the forest ranger would have been handled much differently had it happened today. Based on how I've handled similar calls in my career, I suspect the forest ranger, after driving a long distance with Herbert, later determined Herbert had mental health issues. To further this theory, I noted that Herbert was released and not cited, meaning he was never charged with brandishing a weapon at the forest ranger. I believe the forest ranger knew Herbert. Had he walked into a courtroom in the condition he's been found in, would be released immediately. Judges had no answer for subjects with mental health illnesses in the late 1960s. Based on the fact his parents and some of the friends he'd made while in high school noticed Herbert acting more bizarre, and when he admitted to them that he was using narcotics often, a concerted effort began to get him to seek help. No one wanted him to continue to suffer or fall further into his apparent medical condition. In September of 1969, he checked himself into a drug treatment facility in Santa Cruz, California. He initially did what staff suggested, and he tried to curb his drug use, but his schizophrenia had been left to manifest so long that Herbert had already been lost. While in the program, his behavior deteriorated. He'd repeatedly burn his penis with lit cigarettes. This is not normal or rational behavior. Herbert later said he did this because his penis was to blame for his homosexual thoughts and desires. He enjoyed the pain and sensation of manipulating his penis, which only fueled the raging voices in his head. His self-mutilation, drug use, and diagnosis with schizophrenia should have scared the hell out of people. But back then, even medical professionals didn't have all the answers for Herb's condition. 1 month later, Herbert packed up his belongings and left the drug treatment program. At the same time, he applied for welfare. Herbert recontacted the Goodwill Industries manager he previously worked for and asked for a job. The manager told police that Herb said he was hearing voices and receiving messages. Herbert's manager said he saw the struggle on Herbert's face, but he had no idea what to do to help him. Herbert left the store still confused and, in some way, looking for help. He sought advice from another man, a friend he called his uncle. The man had no family relation to him, and told him about the voices in his head. Before the man could respond, Herbert tried to kiss and caress him. His uncle happened to be a doctor and instantly noted Herbert's actions displayed the classic signs of schizophrenia. The doctor called the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Office. A deputy responded and spoke to Herbert. During the contact with him, the deputy believed Herbert was a risk to himself and others, so he placed him on a 5150 welfare and institutions hold. Herbert was placed in an ambulance and taken to a county psychiatric facility for 72-hour observation. Herbert gained his freedom 3 days later. In today's world, when I place someone on a 5150 hold, they are normally out within a few hours. The person will either take medication or answer the psychiatrist's questions and be released back into the community with no job, funds, food, or a place to stay. Once the medications wear off, if they actually take them because most just cheek them, and the voices come charging back, the individual becomes a problem for society because they cannot control their thoughts. It's a completely broken system. Anyway, Herbert immediately headed south. A female jogger called the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office to report seeing a white male adult arguing with himself and exposing his penis to people as they walked by. A deputy responded and contacted the subject, later identified as Herbert Mullen. The deputy attempted to interview Herbert, but it appeared the subject looked right through the deputy. Once again, Herbert was placed on a 5150 welfare and institutions hold. The deputy requested an ambulance to the scene to transport Herbert to the county general hospital. The deputy indicated on his report that Herbert was placed on the hold because subject appears to suffer from a mental disorder. He is a danger to others, a danger to himself, and gravely disabled. Although the intent of the deputy, while placing Herbert on a hold, was sound, and an effort to help the strange man in his town, Herbert did not like hospitals and did not agree that he had a mental health issue. He went willingly, but made it clear he thought there was nothing wrong with exposing his penis or having discussions within his own head. On November 1, 1969, Herbert wrote a letter and sent it to his parents. In the letter, he told them that he'd been forcibly committed to the psychiatric ward of San Luis Obispo County Hospital. Herbert had become stable, and the letter was articulate. He asked his parents to write back if they could. Joseph Middleton, a psychiatrist working at the hospital, began working with Herbert. Over the next 7 weeks, Joseph and Herbert would have lengthy discussions and therapy sessions. Herbert appeared to trust and respect Joseph. During this time, Dr. Middleton diagnosed Herbert as a paranoid schizophrenic. Dr. Middleton noted that Herbert's schizophrenia could be managed with medications and therapy, but after 1 week, Herbert began to resist his efforts to help him. A few weeks after Herbert had sent the letter to his parents, they came to the hospital and visited with him. They clearly loved their child, but his behavior scared them both. They beat themselves over the head and blamed themselves for Herbert's problems, the standard response of most parents these days. During their visit, Herbert finally told them he preferred male lovers. The statement rocked his father, a traditional conservative military veteran, and his mother just cried. They left not knowing what to do next or what would happen to their son. They'd only hoped for the best for their children, but Herbert seemed as though he no longer wished to put forth the effort required to manage his mental health issues. On November 23, 1967, Herbert was discharged from the hospital. He'd convinced Dr. Middleton that he would sign up for weekly counseling sessions at the Santa Cruz Mental Health Clinic, and needed to be with his parents to recover. There existed no way to force Herbert to attend the sessions, and for the rest of November and all of December, Herbert continued walks in the forest of Santa Cruz, high and delusional from large doses of LSD, and did nothing to help himself. Toward the middle of January of 1970, Herbert began going to the clinic, but his visits were rare. He'd walk in and talk to a few of the other people, checked into the clinic, but did not talk to the staff. Eventually, he attended a couple of therapy sessions, but he did not participate in discussions and looked distant. The only comment he made occurred when he told staff that he stopped taking his medications because they made him feel odd. His parents tried to help, but their relationship had suffered over the years, and Herbert was determined to make it on his own. He found a dishwashing job at a local Holiday Inn and drifted around town, still speaking to himself and trying to shut down the constant voices in his head. In March of 1970, Herbert left his parents' home and found a cheap local hotel to live in. He paid for his room with his welfare checks. He met a man named Ed Lawrence while hanging out around the hotel after work. Mr. Lawrence took Herbert to a local commune in Santa Cruz. The area held Herbert's thoughts. He enjoyed the location and instantly found people he could talk to. However, since he did not go to therapy sessions and did not take medications, the paranoid schizophrenia made him do things people could not understand. He asked Mr. Lawrence if he could move into the commune, but his behavior made the people already at the commune nervous about him. Herbert was persistent and eventually found a spot to lay his head at the commune. While there, he became good friends with a man named Pat Brown. In the summer of 1970, Herbert and Pat took a trip to Maui, Hawaii. They toured the island briefly, but at some point, Pat left Herbert alone on the island and returned to Santa Cruz. Herbert later said they had a disagreement, but would not elaborate on what it was about. Some speculated the whole trip had been planned as a way to get Herbert away from the commune. Others said Herb tried to hit on Pat, and he freaked out and left him. Herbert took the rejection poorly. The locals on Maui introduced him to methamphetamine, another dangerous and addictive drug, and the effects hooked him immediately. The methamphetamine made the voices even more delusional in his head, and he searched for LSD to calm himself, of which he could not find on the island. Fearing he lost all control of himself, he located a mental health clinic on Maui, walked in, and told them he needed help. Staff tried to comfort him prior to him being interviewed by a psychiatrist. He agreed to take medications and was diagnosed with schizoaffective schizophrenia. Herbert remained at the clinic for approximately 4 weeks. His condition became stable and he functioned much better. He completed the program and returned to the streets without a job, a place to live, or any friends or family. In a desperate attempt to make it home, he penned a letter to his parents, requesting money to fly back to Santa Cruz. His parents, who had not seen or heard from him for almost 6 weeks, were ecstatic that he'd reached out to them. Until then, they had feared their son was dead. They sent him money, hoping to see Herbert when he got back to the States. Herbert flew home, and for the first 2 weeks he behaved and acted normally. However, once he started hanging out with his old friends, some from the commune, and he ran out of his medication, he fell back into using drugs, and his behavior deteriorated rapidly. The pattern of identifying his schizophrenia, taking meds and becoming stable, coupled with relapsing while using LSD and methamphetamine, made each time he relapsed more difficult. On July 30th, 1970, Herbert, mind in a different place, jaywalked in front of a Santa Cruz police officer. The officer stopped and contacted Herbert. After a brief discussion, the officer searched Herbert and located drugs in his pockets. In addition, the officer observed that Herbert had the objective signs of being under the influence of a controlled substance. The officer arrested Herbert and booked him at the Santa Cruz County Main Jail. While in custody, Herbert did not receive medications for his schizophrenia and became hyperactive. For hours at a time, he'd sing loudly from his cell. He could not be housed with other inmates because they could not understand his behavior, and he annoyed them. Jail medical staff observed Herbert's behavior and agreed he needed to be placed in the Santa Cruz County Hospital psychiatric ward. His criminal case was dropped as a result of his severe mental health issues. In addition, he was released just 72 hours after being placed in the ward because California law, 5150 Welfare and Institutions Code, limits holding involuntary mental patients past 72 hours. Once released, Herbert seemed to be moving towards becoming more stable again. He went to a health clinic and received medication. He took the medication regularly and kept the schizophrenia in check. He applied for readmission to Cabrillo College to study psychology. However, he missed the pre-entry counseling appointment and was not allowed to re-enroll. Part of his mind told him what he needed to do to become successful, but the other part of his mind, the chaos of schizophrenia, dominated his actions. For some reason, he began focusing anger on his parents and blamed them for his illness. In a fit of rage, he adjusted his life insurance policy to reflect UNICEF as his beneficiary instead of his parents. He reached out to the manager at Goodwill Industries and convinced him to give him a truck driving job. Herbert got his life back on track despite his illness, had a steady job, and began a dating relationship with another man. Although homosexuality in the late 1960s did not have the support it has today, Herbert felt comfortable in his lifestyle choice. Toward the end of 1970 and the beginning of 1971, Herbert maintained a job, but would take his medications intermittently. As a result, he still did things that most people found odd. Known for his long black hair, he shaved his head. He went on a macrobiotic diet and lost weight. He wore a big black sombrero and faked a Mexican accent. Those who knew him understood schizophrenia was slipping back into his life. Herbert later stated he'd been using LSD with his male partner during this time and blamed the drug use for his various costumes and personas. On March 28, 1971, Santa Cruz police officers were called to the report of a man swaying in and out of traffic in front of the police station. Police officers responded and found Herbert extremely intoxicated. When Herbert noticed the officers, he began clenching his fists and shaking uncontrollably. The officers attempted to place him in handcuffs, at which point Herbert violently resisted their efforts. The police report indicated Herbert had superhuman strength and was highly agitated. He was arrested for public intoxication and resisting an officer. The public intoxication charge was later dismissed, but Herbert was held to answer regarding the resisting arrest charge. This misdemeanor resulted in a small fine and 2 days of jail time. During the same time, the officials at the Santa Cruz Mental Health Clinic closed Herbert's case because he failed to attend counseling sessions. Officials at the facility had contacted his parents, and they told the facility they had not seen their son for a few weeks. Protocol at the facility required his case to be closed in order to have room for several other new patients. After Herbert was released from jail, he tried to move back in with his parents. Unlike all the other times before, they did not allow him to move in because they were worried about their own safety when he was around. Herbert's parents had heard enough about their child being a misfit, and the fact he'd fought two officers scared them. In May of 1971, Herbert ended up in San Francisco. With no job or money, he lived in a dilapidated apartment in the Tenderloin area. At that time, the area was inundated with alcoholics, drug addicts, and numerous people suffering similar mental health issues. In this environment, he made a new friend named Alan Hansen. Mr. Hansen agreed with Herbert's views on reincarnation. Mr. Hansen told Herbert the voices he heard were actually telepathy and that Herbert was chosen by God to do something special. Herbert's new friend furthered the distortion in his mind and fueled greater discussions in his own head. During this time, Herbert became fascinated with art and read many books by Leonardo da Vinci. While in the local library researching Albert Einstein, he noted his birth date fell on the anniversary of Albert Einstein's death. His mind rationalized the coincidence as another indication he was a special being meant to do something significant. Obviously, due to the fact he'd been dealing with mental health issues for so long and had been through so much and was not taking his medication for schizophrenia, his mind suffered greatly. In September of 1971, Herbert took up a new interest in boxing. He'd found a gym, the Newman Herman Gym, and worked out there constantly. He began to participate in amateur boxing. He had a small place in San Francisco he called home and found another dishwashing job. He appeared normal, but Donald Lund, a psychiatrist who examined Mullen several years later, believes the time he spent in San Francisco proved to be a critical period in Herbert's psychosis. He lived in decrepit apartments among alcoholics and drug addicts, sinking further into his bizarre belief systems. Several full-blown conversations with different personalities waged in Herbert's head at any given moment. For the next 6 months, Herbert maintained a somewhat normal, by his definition, lifestyle. He learned about his illness, he held a job, and spent a lot of time boxing. In March of 1972, at the age of 24, he applied for and received a permit to box in Golden Gloves. On the night of the fight, his first official bout, he caught his opponent with a right hook and proceeded to pummel the man until people jumped into the ring and physically pulled him off of his opponent. Although Herbert demonstrated talent in boxing, the manner in which he fought forced him from the league, and he would never fight again. The shock of being kicked out of boxing, something he enjoyed and felt good while doing, proved difficult for Herbert. He began taking LSD again, trying to mask his pain, because he could no longer participate in something that he truly loved. In September of 1972, Herbert asked his parents if he could move in with them, and this time they said yes. However, once he moved back, he stopped taking his medication, and his anger towards his father escalated. He would later say that a voice in his head commanded him to kill when he moved back in with his parents. He did not act on the command, but he entertained the thought. However, Herb rationalized killing for a reason. Local scientists had predicted a major earthquake would crush California soon, and Herb, including the voices in his head, focused on preventing the disaster. This was the first time he believed that killing one person might prevent an earthquake that would kill thousands of people. This fascination with an earthquake, coupled with the fact his anger mushroomed overnight and the voices in his head dominated his thoughts, took an immense toll on Herbert. He felt, based on the fact he truly believed at least one of the voices in his head came from God, that he must do something to prevent the major earthquake scientists had predicted. He'd read numerous books about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and felt he must prevent it from happening again. Herbert felt God did not allow another massive earthquake to happen because he, God, was satisfied with all the death in the war. The voice in his head told him he needed to kill people to prevent the earthquake because less people were dying since the war was winding down. Therefore, after years of voices insisting he kill someone but not doing so, Herbert Mullen finally made up his mind to listen to the voices. He justified the fact that if he killed a single person, he'd be saving thousands. Since he rationalized the voice telling him to kill was God himself, and God told him killing one person would save thousands, he felt he had no choice but to become a killer. Chapter 2. Santa Cruz, California, October 13th, 1972. Just northeast of the mystery spot in Santa Cruz, California, 55-year-old Lawrence Whitey White, a local transient known to frequent the area looking for handouts from tourists, walked back towards town looking for a place to shelter for the evening. Somehow, he'd taken a turn down a long winding road, off the beaten path, and ended up in an area unfamiliar to him. Very few houses were in the area, and due to the seclusion, minimal vehicles drove by him. Herbert Mullen, in a small weathered 1958 Chevy station wagon, meandered along the river headed toward the mystery spot, a place he frequented often to calm the voices in his head. He passed Lawrence White along the way. The voices in Herb's head began to argue with one another. One particular voice told him to kill the homeless person that he just drove by. Herbert said later that the victim was Jonah from the Bible, and that he, Jonah, had sent him a telepathic message when he drove by Lawrence saying, "Pick me up and throw me over the boat. Kill me so that others will be saved." Herbert pulled over along the shoulder of the road and exited his vehicle. He opened the hood of his car and tinkered with the engine bay, trying to make it appear he had vehicle problems. The voice screamed in Herbert's head to kill. Lawrence, likely hoping to get some spare change, wandered over to see what was wrong with the man's car. Lawrence and Herbert engaged in small talk, and Herbert asked the man if he knew how to fix his car while pointing to the engine bay. Lawrence bent over to check out the engine, and Herbert raised a baseball bat high in the air and smashed it over Lawrence's head, knocking him to the ground. Herbert then repeatedly bashed Lawrence over and over until his baseball bat and the pavement were covered in blood. Herbert continued to use the bat in a rage similar to the rage he exhibited in his first and only boxing match. He then calmly wiped Lawrence's blood and brain matter from the bat onto Lawrence's clothing. He closed the car hood, entered into his vehicle, and drove away, leaving Lawrence's lifeless body where he had beaten him to death. Herbert later said God told him to kill Lawrence, and he justified the act because he believed the death to be a sacrifice to God, who agreed not to let a massive earthquake happen if Herbert gave him a sacrifice. Herbert was determined to prevent the earthquake at any cost, including murder. Lawrence's body was discovered the following day, and the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Office responded to the scene to investigate the murder. Investigators could clearly see Lawrence had been beaten to death by a blunt object, but beyond that, there were no leads or witnesses to the horrific murder. The nature of the crime and the fact Lawrence, a well-known and harmless transient, had been the victim, caused quite a stir in the community. People could not believe someone would brutally kill Lawrence or anyone else in the community at that time, and could not imagine what he would have done to be treated so poorly. The moment Herbert killed Lawrence forever changed him. After years of numerous voices telling him to kill, he finally acted upon the urge. Voices, completely fabricated as a result of the schizophrenia, took over Herbert's thoughts and dictated what actions he'd take from that point on. He later said in an interview with law enforcement, completely lucid and not hearing voices because he'd started taking medication again, that he'd wanted to kill someone since the day Dean had died, and it felt good to kill the transient on the side of the road. Even when presumed stable and in a controlled environment, jail, and later prison, Herbert showed no remorse for killing Lawrence, an innocent stranger in the wrong place at the wrong time. Left unchecked, a homicidal rage fueled by false pretenses compelled Herbert to seek more victims. He'd easily killed one man. The question remained who and how many more victims would he leave on his murderous path. Chapter 3. Soquel, California, October 24th, 1972. 24-year-old Mary Guilfoyle walked quickly westbound along Soquel Drive toward Cabrillo College. She was late for a job interview and nervous. Hoping to make it in time, she decided to hitchhike. This was not something she'd ever done before, and there had been several warnings from the police not to hitchhike, based on the fact female hitchhikers were being found decapitated in the Santa Cruz area. Still, for some unknown reason, Mary stuck her thumb up, hoping someone would pick her up and get her to the interview on time. A short man, later identified as Herbert Mullen, in a small weathered 1958 Chevy station wagon, saw the young woman, pulled over, and offered to give her a ride. Those who knew Mary believe, based on Herb's physical appearance and demeanor, that she would have easily climbed in his car, assuming he presented no threat. Unfortunately, the man offering to give her a lift was a murderer. The moment he'd laid eyes on her, the voice in his head declared that she must die. Obviously, he never took Mary to the interview. She'd been less than a mile from Cabrillo College when Herbert's helpful hand turned into an abduction, murder, and later, dissection. Herbert drove to a secluded spot off of Sokol Drive, a spot he'd known about from all the time he explored the area looking to calm the voices in his head. The slight young man behind the wheel didn't look like a murderer. Handsome and soft-spoken, Mary, although nervous of what the man's intentions might have been based on the fact they both knew he was traveling the wrong direction, had no idea of the danger she was in. A brief struggle ensued in the car, and Herbert eventually stabbed Mary through her heart and in her back numerous times with the hunting knife he often carried. Based on the account of the incident later shared by Herbert, it appears she died almost instantly. He then drove down a random dirt road, parked, and pulled her body from the car. The front passenger seat and floorboard, covered in Mary's blood, marked the location of Herbert's second gruesome and senseless murder. Mary, such was the case with Lawrence White, had been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Herbert heard a voice telling him Mary was a sacrifice and needed to be offered ritualistically to God. In the same moment, he recalled the Michelangelo book his mother gave him regarding dissection. He kneeled next to her body and proceeded to carve her chest and stomach open with his hunting knife. He pulled out her organs, examined them in his hands, and placed them around her body. He hung her large intestines from tree branches nearby and studied them looking for her impurities. When asked about this murder while in custody in February of 1973, Herbert said the voice told him killing her and carving her was a sacrifice to God, which successfully prevented a major earthquake. He reasoned that the death of a few people prevented thousands of deaths. Herbert maintained that he had saved thousands of people based on his heroic actions. His mind rationalized killing people as heroic acts. Herbert also talked about reading Irving Stone's biography on Michelangelo, The Agony and the Ecstasy. Herbert internalized that to be a serious artist, he needed to dissect a body. Mary became the canvas of a serial killer. Michelangelo spent hours and hours secretly dissecting bodies so he could find out about the form of the human body for his painting and sculpture and stuff. That's why his works are so much better than anyone else's. It gave him insight others didn't have, Herbert mused to a psychologist several years later. His mom had given him the Michelangelo book, hoping it might inspire him to use art as an emotional outlet. Obviously, things did not turn out that way. Herbert actually blamed his mother for this killing, which was the only time he blamed her for any of the killings. He felt his mother gave him the Michelangelo book as a hint that she wanted him to dissect someone. Herbert later stated, "I think she," his mother, "was trying to tell me what to do, so I could have this insight too." As with Lawrence's body, Herbert did not attempt to conceal what he'd done to Mary. He got back into his car and left the area. On February 12, 1973, Mary's skeleton and partial remains were located by a hiker. The huge gap in time and the fact police were not aware of Mary's death provided Herbert Mullen plenty more opportunities to continue to answer the voices inside his head, instructing him to kill. Chapter 4. St. Mary's Church, Los Gatos, California, November 2, 1972. 65-year-old Catholic priest, Father Henri Tome, was hearing confessions at the St. Mary's Catholic Church in Los Gatos, California. A young man entered the church and patiently waited for the confessional to become available. Once the room was available, the young man, a confused and concerned Herbert Mullen, entered the confessional and began talking to Father Tome. Within a few minutes, the guilt of what he'd done forced Herbert to confess to Father Tome that he'd killed two people. Herbert was completely delusional and had not slept for several days. He later discussed the event and recalled being overly tired, prior to talking to Father Tomei. During the time he confessed to the murders of Lawrence and Mary, he described feeling as though a huge weight had been lifted off of him. However, fearing he had said too much and believing Father Tomei would alert the police, Herbert and the voices in his head instantly developed a plan for survival. Herbert ran from his side of the confessional room and found Father Tomei trying to get away on the other side. Father Tomei ran towards the altar, hoping to escape his pursuer, a confessed killer. Herbert sprinted and caught up to Father Tomei and tackled him to the floor of the church. Herbert kicked, beat, and then stabbed Father Tomei repeatedly, killing him inside his own church. Herbert later told police he killed Father Tomei to ensure there were no witnesses to his murders. At least one of the voices in his head convinced him more work needed to be done, and he would not be able to do so were he prematurely exposed. Herbert offered, while talking to an investigator a second time, that he believed Father Tomei volunteered to be his next sacrifice, to prevent the massive earthquake Herb believed was imminent. Herbert fled from the scene, leaving Father Tomei in a pool of his own blood. A parishioner observed the attack and killing, but did not help the priest by calling 911 or going to his side to at least comfort him. The police questioned the witness at length after finding him while responding to a disturbance reported at the church. The witness, shaken by what he'd seen, could not provide a decent description of the attacker and proved useless for the murder investigation. Lacking witnesses, evidence, a murder weapon, surveillance, or any other lead, the murder of Father Tomei remained open but suspended. Residents and close friends of Father Tomei were outraged. They could not believe someone killed their friend and priest, inside the church no less, and they demanded the police find and arrest the suspect immediately. The police requested anyone with information regarding the horrific attack to contact them, but since the incident involved Herbert, who hadn't turned himself in, and Father Tomei, who had passed away, they would not receive a lead until Herbert Mullen's apartment was searched almost 7 months later. When asked about this specific murder during an evaluation for competency, Herbert recounted the situation with the following discussion from his point of view with Father Tomei. Father Tomei. Herbert, do you read the Bible? Herbert. Yes. Father Tomei. The commandments, where it says to honor thy father and mother? Herbert. Yes. Father Tomei. Then you know how important it is to do as your father says. Herbert. Yes. Father Tomei. I think it's so important that I want to volunteer to be your next sacrifice. With each voice becoming louder in his head and three brutal murders on his hands, Herbert decided things were getting too hectic, and he needed to move on. He felt satisfied that he'd answered the voices commanding him to kill, and felt he'd killed enough people to prevent the earthquake, at least for now. Although the chaos in his head continued, became even worse by his own account, and he started using LSD again, he somehow managed to move forward in life. He discounted the use of medication for schizophrenia, believing that he'd cured himself. At the end of November in 1972, he applied to be a Coast Guard cadet. He interviewed well and passed the first portion of the application, earning him the opportunity to be scheduled for a psychological evaluation. Herbert made the appointment for the exam, but failed it miserably. Therefore, his application for the Coast Guard made the rejection pile. Failing the psychological portion of the application process dealt another blow to an already damaged man. One wonders if the fact he killed three people in cold blood prior to the exam had any impact on his ability to pass. With so many voices carrying on inside of his head, three of which were the voices of the people he'd already killed, it seems taking such an exam would be quite difficult to pass. The fact that he failed to get into the Coast Guard would be yet another reason for Herbert to snap. His mind could not fathom how he could not pass a psychological exam, and he felt embarrassed for failing to join the military. The struggle with his mental health, and constantly feeling the need to impress his father, wore on him daily. His peaks and valleys with regard to emotion cannot be understood by anyone but Herbert. He took up reading again, hoping to educate himself more on the human mind, body, and soul, in an effort to pass any future psychological exams. One of the authors he thoroughly enjoyed reading was Albert Einstein. No one would have guessed that reading one of Einstein's novels would lead to Herbert's condition getting much, much worse. Chapter 5. Santa Cruz, California, December 16, 1972. According to California Department of Justice firearms records, Herbert purchased his first gun on December 16, 1972. He claimed he read Albert Einstein's novel, Einstein on Peace, and learned that in Switzerland, every adult male in the militia kept a gun for protection. Herbert examined and traced his family tree and determined he was one-third Scandinavian, and therefore he needed a gun. During the time Herbert had killed his first three victims, and while he stumbled through life suffering major hallucinations, another serial killer claimed several victims in the same area where Herbert had killed Lawrence, Mary, and Father Tomei. Edmund Kemper, a.k.a. the Coed Killer, preyed on female hitchhikers in the Santa Cruz area. He'd abduct them, dismember their bodies, and have sex with their corpses. That Kemper focused on female hitchhikers, and Herbert's victims were both male and female, but two were classified as hitchhikers, Lawrence and Mary. Local law enforcement could not be certain whether they were dealing with one or two killers, or worse, a copycat killer. As law enforcement desperately tried to identify the killer or killers, both Kemper and Herbert were allowed to continue their murder sprees. The community, particularly young female adults, were told to stay indoors and not to hitchhike. However, the Santa Cruz Police Department and Sheriff's Office had no way to convince residents to remain calm. The bottom line during this time in Santa Cruz was that women and men were being killed, and no suspects or suspect had been identified. Santa Cruz County residents were on edge. In 1970, John Lindley Frazier terrorized the town with his cold-blood execution of the Ota family and secretary. A note under the windshield wiper of the Ota's Rolls-Royce stated, "Today, World War III will begin, as brought to you by the people of the free universe," and warned that anyone abusing the environment for the sake of materialism will die. Gun sales rose abruptly, particularly with homeowners who took the threat seriously. Some thought the murders were part of an ecological cult, but Frazier, who was later diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, had acted alone. He wasn't the only one in the area in time frame killing, however. Female hitchhikers began vanishing in April of 1972. Some had been found decapitated. On February 5, 1973, Alice Liu and Rosalind Thorpe disappeared. The next day, a 79-year-old widow was found raped and strangled to death in her bathtub in Santa Cruz. Before February ended, six more victims would be discovered. In addition, many hitchhikers were being raped. Police had no idea who was committing the offenses or if there were multiple killers and suspects, but they had absolutely no control of their town. A few days after the Liu and Thorpe disappearance, Mary Guilfoyle's skeleton was discovered. Earlier, Cynthia Shaw's body had been found strewn along the coast in parts, and Mary Ann Pesk's head was discovered in the Loma Prieta Mountains. For some reason, college-aged women continued to hitchhike, insisting it was a lifestyle and they were determined to do their own thing. The huge increase of murders gave Santa Cruz the title Murderville, USA. Much of the unwanted notoriety came following Herbert Mullen's next chapter in life. On January 15, 1973, Herbert convinced himself he should follow in his father's footsteps. This would appear abnormal, since he'd been arguing with his father for years, and suggested many times that his father did not love him. He walked into a Marine recruiting center and signed up to join the U.S. military. This time, not only did he pass the physical examination, but he also passed the psychological examination. The process continued smoothly until the recruiter asked Herbert to sign a document, giving the recruiter the authority to examine his criminal record. At first, Herbert refused to sign the release, but the recruiter told him if he didn't, his dream of being a Marine would not come true. Fearing yet another failure, Herbert signed the form. Immediately after signing, however, he told the recruiter his previous charges should have been dropped and were all a misunderstanding. Eventually, the recruiter obtained Herbert's criminal record and determined he could not be in the military due to heavy drug use and assault on a peace officer. Therefore, as with the Coast Guard, Herbert's ideation of joining the military disappeared. Yet again, after wanting something so bad and trying his best to obtain it, Herbert lost another opportunity. 4 days later, after a big fight with his father, he moved out. He used all of what he'd saved to secure a rundown apartment near Cabrillo College, the same area where he had picked up Mary before killing and dissecting her. Herbert later said the fight developed because his parents were tired of all the criticism launched their way by friends and neighbors regarding his abnormal behavior. Herbert still wanted to be accepted by his parents, however, and told his dad he'd try to join the army. And in the meantime, he did odd jobs to make ends meet. By all accounts, Herbert could charm the ladies, and many who knew him felt sorry for him because they knew he was sick. It was as though a switch would flip in his mind from normal to serial killer. Many who've suffered from schizophrenia attest to the switch, and no one seems to know what would flip it. The voices in his head never stopped. In fact, every moment he spent awake provided the voices time to continually harass him. He'd stop taking drugs, but then relapse. He'd get high on LSD and the voices in his head, distorted and angry, caused him to consider suicide. Compounding his mental health issues was the fact he refused to take prescribed medication for schizophrenia. The battle between good and evil, sane and insane, peaked within Herbert's head. On January 25, 1973, one particular voice, a voice he later claimed to be God, told him he needed to kill James Gianera. James had been the person who exposed Herbert to marijuana for the first time, and Herbert felt he would have been normal and not hear voices, were it not for the fact James had tricked him to use marijuana. Armed with his gun and carrying his trusty hunting knife, the one he used to butcher Mary and kill Father Tomei, Herb drove over to James' house, a small home in Santa Cruz. Originally, the voice told him he needed to kill James, and no one else. His hatred for James grew every moment, and he could not rest until the man was dead. Herbert got out of his car, focused on killing James. He'd spent the better part of an hour sitting in his car, stroking his knife and staring at James' house. After knocking on the front door, a woman, Kathy Francis, answered. Herbert did not recognize the woman, and he felt embarrassed since he'd been looking for James. Using his charm, he persuaded Kathy to tell him where James and his wife, Joan, had moved. She told him the couple had purchased a small home, still in town, after recently getting married. Kathy gave him James' exact new address. He left completely intent on finding and killing James Gianera. While pulling up to the new address, Herbert saw a vehicle he knew belonged to James. They'd done several drug deals in the vehicle over the last 2 years. He later said he recalled smiling wide when he saw James's car in the driveway. Now several voices chanted, "Kill, kill, kill," in his head. Herbert knocked on the door, and James Gianera answered. He pushed his way by him and pulled out his gun and yelled, "You're clap-trapping me!" James turned to run to alert his wife bathing upstairs, and Herbert shot him in the back. James fell to the floor, but dragged himself towards the stairs, desperate to warn his new wife of the madman, once his friend and customer, coming to get her. Herbert patiently and slowly followed James, then shot him in the head. He then heard Joan screaming, entered the bathroom, and shot her in the head. James was only 24 years old, and Joan was only 23 years old, at the time Herbert, at the direction of schizophrenic voices in his head, shot and killed them. Herbert wiped some of James's blood off his face and put the gun back in his pocket. He then retrieved his knife and stabbed James, already dead, over 35 times. He gained his composure, walked over to Joan, and stabbed her numerous times. She too was already dead before he stabbed her repeatedly. The voices in his head were satisfied James and Joan were dead. He calmly left the scene as though nothing had happened. No one called to report the shootings to the police, and the Gianeras were not located until much later in the day. Friends came over, although the police suspected the friends were looking to score some marijuana, and found the bloody crime scene and called the police. At this point, Herbert grew concerned that someone would find out that James and his wife were dead. He rationalized that the police would ask around and learn he'd been asking about where James lived. The only person who knew he was looking for James was the woman who answered the door at his old place, Kathy Francis. A voice in his head told him he could not leave any witnesses. He stroked his gun and checked to see he had his knife on him, and then drove back to Kathy Francis's home. Herbert, highly intelligent and possessing great memory, noticed the vehicle he saw in her driveway from earlier still there. He sat in his car for some time listening to voices. Herbert later said he didn't want to kill Kathy, but ultimately the voices were correct. She had to die, so he wouldn't get in trouble. This rationale that of trying to cover his tracks would be extremely significant when Herbert was apprehended. He exited the car and casually walked up to the front door. He knocked and Kathy opened the door. Herbert grabbed her and forced his way through the threshold and slammed the door closed. Somehow, Kathy broke free of his grasp, at which point Herbert shot her once in the back and once in the head. She fell dead to the floor. The gunfire within the home frightened her two young children, Damon Francis, age 4, and David Hughes, age 9, causing them to hide underneath their bunk beds upstairs. Herbert went upstairs, found the children crying, and, based on the fact there could be no witnesses, he shot and killed them both. He then stabbed all three victims repeatedly in another fit of rage. Kathy was 30 years old the day Herbert murdered her. As with the Gianeras murders, no one called to report gunshots being fired at the Francis home. Herbert cleaned himself up, loaded his gun again, and left the home without any remorse or concern about killing three more innocent people, two of which were young children. This brought his total number of murder victims to 8, all of whom were killed based on hallucinations in Herbert's head. He truly believed these murders were saving Californians from a major earthquake. Without interviewing someone who suffers from schizophrenia, particularly paranoid schizophrenia, you cannot appreciate how real these voices can be to those who hear them. Over the years, I've contacted numerous people suffering from schizophrenia. The pain on their face while voices argue in their own head is real. Those who take their medications and seek therapy can live normal lives. Those who do not seek or find help suffer tremendously and end up feeling completely alone. Local law enforcement received a frantic call advising them of the horrific murder scene several hours later when Kathy's mother discovered the scene, when she came by to babysit the children. Investigators were already tied up at the Gianeras murder scene, so a request for assistance was made to several outside agencies, including the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Office and San Jose Police Department. Although no immediate evidence existed that the two murder scenes were connected, local law enforcement, based on how the people were murdered, all appeared shot in the head and stabbed, determined some connection likely existed, and they just hadn't identified it yet. Investigators noted there was no forced entry at either location, suggesting the victims knew their killer. A massive manhunt began for the killer, but it's difficult to find someone that you cannot identify. In addition, local law enforcement exhausted considerable resources looking for serial killer Edmund Kemper, leaving the smaller police departments nearly depleted. At one point, the investigators considered the two crime scenes to be a drug buy that had gone bad. Both Bob Francis and Jim Gianera were known marijuana dealers. Bob Francis was located by police and cleared of being a suspect. The police then asked him to come up with any suspects he thought could kill his family and the Gianeras. Bob produced a long list of drug dealers, rivals, and other possible suspects, but Herbert Mullen appeared nowhere on the list. His name never crossed Bob's mind since he hadn't seen Herbert since the summer of 1971, when Herbert did 10 hits of acid during a visit. A few months later, the summer of 1971, Herbert sent James Gianera a weird letter asking him who he's going to vote for in the upcoming November elections. James shared the letter with Bob Francis, and they laughed about it. Neither James nor Bob gave Herbert Mullen much thought after the weird letter they'd received, which is why Bob did not list him as a possible suspect for the murders. The thing has a pattern to it. It's not a case of some crazy man running around shooting people. Santa Cruz Police Captain Overton trying to quell public concern after the Gianera Francis murders. A pattern certainly existed, but a crazy man had been running around shooting people as well. Left alone with his disturbing thoughts, Herbert walked around town completely oblivious to the unbelievable carnage he'd left in his path. It seemed once his mind processed that the threats were no longer viable towards his own safety, he completely dismissed the fact that he killed 8 people, including 2 small children. He drove out to the Santa Cruz Hills, towards Henry Cowell State Park in Felton, California, because the location sometimes made the voices in his head less active. However, the faces and expressions of his victims as he killed them, and some small side of him knowing killing them to be wrong, caused the voices to argue. As he tried to figure out what to do next, Herbert stumbled upon a group of teenage campers and chose to continue his quest to save California. Chapter 6. Felton, California, February 6, 1973. While walking along one of the trails at Henry Cowell State Park, looking for peace and quiet, Herbert saw a large tent in the redwood trees and decided to investigate. He heard teenagers talking near the tent and noticed that they were drinking beer and left a lot of trash in the open. The voices in his head told him the kids should not be in the park because they were polluting. The campers, David Allen Oliker, aged 18, Robert Michael Spector, aged 18, Brian Scott Card, aged 19, and Mark John Dre Belbus, aged 19, refused to leave. Herbert told them he was a park ranger and they needed to leave. Again, they didn't listen to Herb. In fact, Herbert later said they talked down to him and made him feel inferior. Herbert noticed the group had a .22 rifle with them and decided, at least initially, to leave them alone. He left briefly, but then the voices convinced him he must kill the campers. He began speaking to the campers telepathically. He asked each of them if he could kill them. Each replied yes. Knowing they were armed, he circled around and approached them from a different angle, apparently trying to kill the person closest to the rifle first to allow him a better chance of surviving the confrontation. The young adult saw Herbert and dismissed him again. He pulled out his gun and shot all 4 of them to death. He considered mutilating their bodies, mostly because they had disrespected him, but ultimately he decided not to. Herbert left the victims precisely as they were when he killed them. Once again, the voices in his head calmed considerably. He grabbed their rifle and left the campsite without a hint of remorse for what he'd just done. Similar to that of Dean Robertson, these 4 young men and teenagers were killed before really experiencing life. As with his other killings, a total now of up to 12, no report surfaced about gunshots being fired in the state park. At the time, many people had rifles and handguns and often shot them on camping trips. State parks had rangers, but very few actually walked the trails or left the main entrance buildings. Likewise, in the early 1970s, shooting a rifle or gun out in the woods was generally accepted, and no one cared too much about it. Still, it seems unbelievable that Herbert had shot and killed so many people in three different locations, and not a single incident had been reported to law enforcement until after the bodies were discovered. 6 days later, Mary Guilfoyle's dissected body, mostly skeletal remains, was located in the Santa Cruz Hills. Law enforcement responded to the scene, and the discovery of human bones led them to believe the victim had likely been murdered. Investigators called a forensic specialist to the scene who quickly determined, based on the skeletal remains, that the victim was female. The same specialist noticed what she believed to be human intestines on a tree branch near the skeleton and instantly ruled the scene as a homicide. Police initially assumed the woman had been killed by Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer, based on the fact the victim was female, her body had been dismembered, and her remains were located just off the roadway, suggesting she could have been a hitchhiker. This assumption led them away from Herbert Mullen as a suspect in this murder, and when she was found, Herbert Mullen was not a suspect for any of the killings. The four murdered campers brought Herbert's killing total up to 12. He'd used a gun in the majority of his killings, done the murders in broad daylight over the course of 4 months, with 9 murders in less than 2 weeks, and not a single lead indicating he killed them had been developed by police. In addition, no one ever suggested Herbert Mullen would be a suspect in these killings, because he'd been labeled as one of the town's local psych cases. Many people classified Herbert as harmless but mentally unfit. Only one witness existed to any of his killings, that being the male adult who saw him kill Father Tomei, but the witness could not provide police enough details to include Herbert as a suspect in the murder. The bottom line, however, was that serial killer Edmund Kemper and serial killer Herbert Mullen were killing people in and around Santa Cruz area at an alarming rate. Citizens were furious, but even more scared. Every major newspaper ran articles daily about the victims and urged people with information to come forward. Eventually, after killing his own mother and fleeing to Colorado, Edmund Kemper called the Santa Cruz Police Department and turned himself in. He immediately confessed 8 murders, but none of them were the people Herbert had killed. The police asked Kemper about the murders Herbert had committed, but Kemper denied having anything to do with them. The clarity and fashion of his confession, coupled with the details of his murders, led police to believe Kemper did not kill the other 8 victims. Police were unaware of the 4 campers at this point that they had in their town. Instead of being happy about the apprehension of Kemper, a horrific serial killer, the police were confused and concerned as they were back to square one regarding who killed the remaining victims. Pretty much every known criminal in town with a violent criminal history was contacted and cleared as possible suspects. Frustration spilt into the community, desperate for their own answers. As the horrible situation continued, tragedy, at the hands of Herbert Mullen, struck yet again. Chapter 7. Santa Cruz, California, February 13, 1973. 72-year-old Fred Perez, a military veteran and prize boxer, was weeding the front yard of his modest home in Felton, California. He took pride in his home and liked it to look nice. On the porch sat a nice glass of cold tea, and some tunes were being played to help pass the time. It was warmer than usual, and after the winter rains, the weeds had more than doubled. Retirement had been good to him, and despite his age, his outlook on life was high. Herbert Mullen, voices in his head on full tilt, felt that he needed to kill again. The decision was made final as he was loading firewood to bring to his parents' home. He later said his father telepathically said to him not to bring the wood home unless he killed someone first. Herbert said his father told him telepathically, "Don't deliver a stick of wood until you kill somebody." The voice suggested his own uncle, Enos, to be the next victim, but Herbert resisted the suggestion. He said the voices told him, "Just kill somebody, anybody." Fred Bettis had no idea that pure evil had just driven by him. Herbert exited his vehicle after pulling over when he locked eyes onto Fred weeding in his front yard. Herbert grabbed the rifle he'd taken from the campsite after he'd killed the four campers, carefully lined up Fred, and pulled the trigger. The round went almost directly through Fred's heart, killing him instantly. After he senselessly killed Fred, he got back into his car and sat for a while. He held the rifle he used to kill Fred like it was a precious object to him. He then started the car, pulled out into the lane of traffic, and drove away slowly. "He was someone I respected," Mullen later said, although he didn't know Fred Bettis. He had no explanation for why he shot Bettis, which he still has never offered to this day, beyond the fact voices told him to do so. The prosecution in this case would later argue, which I feel is accurate, that this was a come-catch-me crime, and that Herbert wanted to be caught. However, unlike the majority of his other killings, a witness saw him kill Fred. The neighbor heard a single gunshot and peered out her window. She noted the vehicle, driver, and direction of travel of the suspect. As the vehicle slowly drove by her, she also wrote down the license plate. The neighbor called the police, as did a few other callers, and the police were dispatched to check the area of reported shots fired, with a man down. Chapter 8. Herbert drove along, in my opinion, so slowly that it seemed as though he'd grown tired of killing and wanted to be caught. He'd hidden the rifle he used to kill Mr. Perez under a brown paper bag in the front seat with him and drove toward Felton to deliver firewood to his parents, satisfied he'd answer his father's request to kill someone. A marked police officer with no backup saw the vehicle reportedly involved with the shooting, confirmed the license plate, and activated his lights and sirens to pull the vehicle over. There was no way the officer had any idea who sat in the driver's seat of the vehicle, what he'd done, or what he was capable of. Not knowing who's driving a vehicle that I'm about to pull over is a nerve-wracking feeling, one that keeps the hair standing upright on the back of my neck. These routine traffic stops are responsible for police officer deaths around the country. I pulled over a person wanted for murder early on in my career, and I still consider every second of the contact with the suspect. I share my experience with my coworkers, hoping they don't become complacent. But the way this traffic stop was handled back then was how things were done. Herbert glanced in the rearview mirror and noticed the flashing lights of the patrolman. The voices in his head made it almost impossible to hear the police vehicle sirens. Herbert casually slowed down, pulled over, and turned off the vehicle. He later offered that he'd been so tired and he pulled over to finally rest. Years later, while reminiscing about the murder of Fred Bettis, he laughed about how easily it would have been to kill the officer that pulled him over that day. The officer approached Herbert about the same time he learned over his radio that a dead body had been located in the area where Fred's neighbor had reported the gunshot. The officer, obviously jacked up on adrenaline, ordered Herbert out of the car at gunpoint. Herb cooperated fully, and the officer handcuffed him. The officer later located the rifle Herbert had used to kill Fred Bettis, which was later linked, 3 days later, to the discovery of four dead teenagers at a campsite. Although during the arrest Herbert was cooperative, he chose not to speak for quite some time, making it very difficult for police to figure out whom exactly Herbert Mullen was, or that he'd killed many other people that they had no idea about. While at the police station, several different officers asked Herbert questions like, "Do you have an attorney?" or "Would you like to make a phone call?" Each time he laughed uncontrollably and yelled, "Silence!" He chanted the word repeatedly, driving the people in the station nutty. Herbert was sent to a solitary cell based on his refusal to cooperate with the police. On his way to the cell, he yelled, "You people were responsible for the 3 million killed in World War II." The police station happened to have a doctor on scene. He began physically examining Herbert and located a tattoo on his stomach that read, "Legalized acid." The doctor noted several other tattoos that read, "Eagle-eyes marijuana," "birth," "Mahashmamadi," and "Kriya Yoga." Both the doctor and the police were baffled by Herbert's tattoos. Herbert's revolver had been located in his vehicle after it had been towed away to the police station. The handgun made its way to the county crime lab for immediate analysis. Once in custody, the wheels of justice involving Herbert Mullen began moving quickly. Herbert was not yet connected to the murder of Fred Perez. They located a rifle in his vehicle after he'd been arrested, but did not know the significance of it at the time. As noted above, they also located a handgun in the lining beneath the driver's seat. At this point, police still did not know they'd apprehended a serial killer. Based on the witness, Fred Perez's murder, statements, and the items located in Herbert's vehicle, detectives sought and obtained a search warrant for his apartment. On February 14, 1973, police, in full raid gear, served knock and notice and kicked the door in at his apartment when no one answered. Once inside, the officers found much more than they previously assumed. Police located a Bible believed to be taken during the murder of Father Tomei, an address book listing James Gianera's recent address, the scene where Herbert had killed James and Joan Gianera, and a rosary pouch that belonged to Father Tomei. Throughout the apartment were numerous newspaper clippings, not only involving the murders of Mary, Father Tomei, and Lawrence, but also the murders of Kathy, her two children, and the Gianeras. They also found the following note suspected of being written by Herbert. "Let it be known to the nations of Earth and the people that inhabit it, this document carries more power than any other written before. Such a tragedy as what has happened should not have happened, and because of this action, which I take of my own free will, I am making it possible to occur again, for while I can be here, I must guide and protect my dynasty." Police struggled to believe Herbert, a diminutive young man, might also be the person beheading female hitchhikers. The day following his arrest, officials announced that ballistics from the gun recovered in his vehicle proved that he'd also killed the Francis family and the Gianeras. The community felt confused. They saw 25-year-old Herbert as bright, deeply religious, but somewhat uptight, and obviously suffering from mental health issues. Only later would people understand that Herbert had succumbed to heavy drug use, and the results of the drugs on his mind led to his murder spree. The search warrant, and what police discovered as a result of the warrant, armed them with numerous pieces of substantial evidence against Herbert for the murders of Father Tomei, James Gianera, Joan Gianera, Kathleen Prentice, a.k.a. Kathy Francis, David Hughes, and Damon Francis. 3 days later, the bodies of Robert Spector, David Oliker, Brian Scott Card, and Mark Dre Belbus were located in the campsite where Herbert had murdered them. His pistol matched the bullet fragments found at the scene, and you recall he'd been found in possession of the rifle the teenagers had at their campsite. Therefore, Herbert would be charged with their murders as well, bringing the total up to 13. Knowing they had their prime suspect in custody, investigators did not waste time and began interrogating Herbert Mullen. The following is an excerpt from one of the first interrogations police conducted with Herbert. Question: "You say it started with revenge, but that it also had to do with preventing earthquakes, which I guess other people had been doing. Other people were killing other people, which was keeping the earth quiet, in particular the San Andreas fault, or in general, or what?" Answer: "All faults. We human beings, through the history of the world, have protected our continents from cataclysmic earthquakes by murder. In other words, a minor natural disaster avoids a major natural disaster." Question. But if murder is a natural disaster, then why should you be locked up for it if it's natural and has a good effect? Answer. Your laws. You see, the thing is, people get together, say, in the White House. People like to sing the die song. You know, people like to sing that die song. If I'm president of my class when I graduate from high school, I can tell two, possible three young Homo sapiens to die. I can sing that song to them and they'll have to kill themselves or be killed. An automobile accident, a knifing, a gunshot wound. And you ask me why this is? And I say, well, they have to do that in order to protect the ground from an earthquake. Because all of the other people in the community, because all the other people in the community have been dying all year long. And my class, we have to chip in, so to speak, to the darkness. We have to die also. And people would rather sing the die song than murder. Question. What is the die song? Answer. Just that. I'm telling you to die. I'm telling you to kill yourself or be killed so that my continent will not fall off the ocean. See, it's all based on reincarnation. This dies to protect my strata. The investigators were concerned that their suspect, at the time considered involved in 13 murders, might not be found sane to stand a criminal trial based on his behavior and how he answered their questions. Nevertheless, they continued to interview him, hoping to build an airtight case against the man. They were hopeful the point of whether or not he could stand trial would work itself out later. Chapter 9. Santa Cruz County Superior Court, 1973. Is the serial killer sane or insane? On March 1, 1973, Herbert Mullen was officially charged with 13 counts of first-degree murder. Herbert chose on this first court date to represent himself. He entered the courtroom carrying a legal book and promptly stated, "Your Honor, I'd like to plead guilty." The courtroom scene, something similar to an Albert Hitchcock horror movie, stirred with buzz as a serial killer easily announced that he'd killed 13 people. However, legal process had to be followed, and the judge refused to accept Herbert's guilty plea. The judge stated, "In a case of such magnitude, I won't accept that." Herbert snickered and replied, "You gave me a choice, and I chose." Herbert's state-appointed attorney tried to intervene, at which point Herbert held his hand up to the man and said, "I refuse counsel." Despite Herbert's antics in the courtroom, the judge assigned him a public defender, attorney James Jackson. Herbert did not support the move and would continue to request that he be allowed to represent himself throughout his court hearings. A bailiff told Herbert he'd had enough of his banter, while the judge told him he would no longer entertain discussions about defense attorney Jackson representing him. Herbert pointed at Jackson and said, "I don't care to be represented by a long hair." The judge reasoned with Herbert that Mr. Jackson, despite having long and bushy hair, could represent him well enough. As an interesting side note, James Jackson, who represented John Lindley Frazier, would later represent Edmund Kemper. I find it fascinating that one public defender represented three serial killers in their career. Some argue that had any of the three serial killers had a paid-for-hire attorney, at least one of them would have remained free. Herbert and the judge continued to banter with each other about Jackson. However, once Herbert felt he'd lost his argument, he blurted out, "In that case, I plead guilty to the counts of first-degree murder." The discussion between a presiding judge and a paranoid schizophrenic had gone full circle, with no progress being made. The judge quickly lost patience with Herbert, and the high-profile case hadn't even begun due process. At this point, the judge considered whether or not Herbert should stand trial based on a growing concern that Herbert might not be competent. The prosecutor, Deputy District Attorney Chang, blurted out, "You can't just hand a guy a complaint and let him plead guilty to 10 counts of first-degree murder. If we let him plead guilty, we'd be thrown out on our ear by the Supreme Court." The judge considered his options and what DDA Chang had said. He decided further investigation would be needed prior to the case being heard. Both the defense and prosecution requested Herbert be evaluated by two independent psychiatrists to determine his competency. The murder hearings were suspended until the court could be satisfied that Herbert should and could stand trial. Psychiatrists were called in to examine Herbert. Without hesitation, both men who interviewed Herbert diagnosed him as paranoid schizophrenic. They said he suffered from auditory hallucinations, distorted thinking, and developed a delusional belief system of self-importance. They agreed that Herbert believed himself to be psychic and spoke to God. The psychiatrist noted even when evidence shown to Herbert clearly indicated no one was actually after him, he convinced himself that a grand conspiracy continued anyway. His extensive medical records, the sit-downs with psychiatrists, and his behavior clearly indicated that Herbert Mullen suffered from serious mental illness. Law enforcement, the court, the victims and the prosecution knew Herbert had killed 13 people, but this trial would be about whether or not he was sane. The McNaughton Standard states that if a defendant understood the difference between right and wrong, that the defendant is guilty. If a defendant makes an attempt to conceal the crime, this can be taken as evidence that the defendant knew it to be wrong. If the court ruled Herbert was legally insane, the case against him would be dropped, and he'd be ruled not guilty based on his insanity. Therefore, the things Herbert did after he killed his victims were closely examined to demonstrate he tried to cover them up, and therefore, by the McNaughton standard, was sane and competent to stand trial. The defense focused on another area, trying to convince the court that Herbert could not stand trial, that of a term known as diminished capacity. Defense attorney Jackson argued that if Herbert did not understand the meaning of his actions, he could not be found guilty of first-degree murder. Jackson attempted to enter Herbert's doctrines that he wrote while in custody during the case as evidence to suggest he suffered from dementia and therefore did not understand his actions while he killed 10 people. While the court hearings played out, Herbert sat in his jail cell and would jot down his philosophical views, determined to explain his actions to the court. And during this time, he wrote a lot about earthquakes, Jonah, and Einstein. Jackson hoped his client's delusional thoughts would support the attempt to show him to be insane. The court allowed these notes to be entered as evidence, and Jackson was confident they'd indicate that his client was truly insane. "Make no mistake, Mr. Mullen hears voices, and the voices told him to kill," said defense attorney Jackson. "These were not acts of murder, but acts of sacrifice." Jackson focused on Herbert's bizarre behavior before the murder sprees. He told how his client thought he was a Mexican laborer, columnist Herb Cain, and an Eastern philosopher. Jackson, feeling his presentation to the court was gaining legs, then discussed Herbert's killjoy sadism conspiracy theory. Herbert argued through Jackson that everyone in his life meant to destroy his chances for happiness, both in this life and afterlife, and therefore he had to kill them. Unsurprisingly, the psychiatrist for the defense determined Herbert was insane, while the psychiatrist for the prosecution determined him to be sane and competent for trial. Hoping to ensure the case would stand against the Court of Appeal examination, the judge requested a third independent psychiatric review of Herbert. The third court-appointed psychiatrist, Dr. Charles Morris, said Herbert's motivation for some of the murders was pure hatred. Herbert told the psychiatrist, "Jim introduced me to LSD, and that ruined my life, so I took revenge." Psychiatrist Charles Morris testified, after examining Herbert, that he believed Herbert was legally insane when he killed Lawrence, Mary, and Father Tomei, but offered in his opinion that Herbert was legally sane during the last 10 murders. Recall that in January of 1973, after Herbert stopped using LSD, hoping to become a Marine, he killed out of revenge, except in the case of Fred Perez. Dr. Morris said Herbert was morally numb after his killing of the first three victims. And killing again, particularly out of anger, carried no moral consequences for Herbert. He argued, and I agree, that Herbert killed Fred Bettis because he was tired and wanted to get caught. To this point, Herbert had killed numerous times and never been caught. We'll later learn that he took various precautions to ensure he would not get caught or be charged with these murders. Given the fact he shot and killed Mr. Bettis in broad daylight, in a busy neighborhood, and did not leave the scene quickly, drove so slow as to almost ensure he'd be apprehended, and did not make an attempt to cover up the fact that he just killed Mr. Bettis, I think Dr. Morris was spot on in his assessment that Herbert actually wanted to be caught. Dr. Morris then focused on the LSD use by Herbert, and suggested the usage precipitated the remaining murders. Defense Attorney Jackson read a note from his client and asked the doctor if the rambling could have been written by someone using drugs. He replied, "Yes, that's possible." The note was dated July 1973, months after Herbert had been incarcerated. The note was a complaint by Herbert to the judge regarding court procedure. Satisfied with what he'd heard, the judge's ruling followed in line with what Dr. Morris stated and found Herbert competent to stand trial for 10 murders, but not competent for the murders of Lawrence, Mary, and Father Tomei. It should be noted here that the families of these victims and local law enforcement were disgusted by the judge's opinion not to try Herbert for their murders. They wrote letters and placed numerous phone calls, but ultimately, the judge's ruling stood. In a bizarre twist of fate, Herbert would come face-to-face with Edmund Kemper prior to his trial beginning. "Yes, judging from my years in Atascadero, I would say he's mentally ill," Edmund Kemper claimed about Herbert Mullen. Kemper had terrorized Santa Cruz and earned the name the Coed Killer. He'd earned the name after a disgusting killing spree in April of 1973. Although he focused his rage on female hitchhikers, Kemper also killed and dismembered his own mother and her friend. Someone working at the jail thought it'd be funny to give the serial killers adjoining cells, but the move immediately backfired. At 6'9", Kemper towered over Herbert. He used his height to bully Herbert every chance he got. Well, he, Herbert, had a habit of singing and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV, so I threw water on him to shut him up. And then, when he was a good boy, I'd give him some peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective because pretty soon he asked permission to sing, and that's called behavior modification treatment, said Kemper in an interview. Kemper described Herbert as a creep with no class, and offered to rat on Herbert if he heard him, Herbert, say anything incriminating. And on the other hand, Herbert constantly called the guards and begged them to move Kemper because Kemper would intentionally be loud as he tried to meditate. Both serial killers believed the killing they'd done merely stemmed from a mission they chose to accept, although they were disgusted by each other. Herbert tried to save the world while he viewed Kemper as a punishing brute that happened to be a raging sex maniac. Kemper described Herbert as just a cold-blooded killer, killing everyone he saw for no good reason. Kemper felt his actions were some sort of a social statement, meant to demonstrate to local Santa Cruz law enforcement they could not protect the young women society treasured most. And part of their feud stemmed from Kemper having mother issues, while Herbert had father issues. Nevertheless, having two serial killers in the same jail, and in cells next to each other, required the correctional officers to be patient. Many of them could not wait for the trials to begin. They had no idea things could actually become worse while waiting for a ruling. Chapter 10. Santa Cruz County Superior Court, 1973. Herbert Mullen takes the stand. Herbert, despite the adamant protests of his attorney, demanded he be allowed to take the stand. Numerous times he spoke directly to the judge about his demand to take the stand, and eventually his attorney allowed him to do so. Those present looked at Herbert, dressed nicely and appearing small and weak, and did not know what to think. He rocked back and forth in the chair. He showed no emotion, and he would stare straight ahead at a point on the wall, as witnesses testified. Strangely, he did not support Jackson's attempt to portray him insane. He'd waited patiently until allowed to get on the stand and tell everyone why he killed 10 people. His testimony, although at times completely scattered, ended up being compelling and somewhat of a shock to those in the courtroom. Herbert stood in the witness box with many notes and blamed his friends, family, and teachers because they wanted to keep him from becoming too powerful in the next life. Herbert argued that everyone on earth bargained for power and position in the next life. "I am chosen as a designated leader of my generation," he said, "because Einstein died on his birthday. This birthday," he snickered, "also gives me an extremely dominant position in the reincarnation." Those in the courtroom struggled to follow Herbert's logic. "One man consenting to be murdered protects the millions of other human beings living in the cataclysmic earthquake tidal area. For this reason, the designated hero, leader, and associates have the responsibilities of getting enough people to commit suicide and or consent to being murdered every day," Herbert declared while staring at the members of the jury. When cross-examined by the prosecution about the victims in the case, Herbert answered, "I never thought about them. I wasn't thinking. I don't think. I was reacting." He again alleged that his victims consented to be killed and did so through psychic transmissions. "Every Homo sapien communicates by mental telepathy. It's just not accepted socially," Herbert told the jury. He blamed his father for everything and asked that he, his father was present, be removed from the courtroom before he continued with his testimony. The judge refused but asked Mr. Mullen to change seats so his son could not see him directly. Herbert then blamed the Santa Cruz Police Department for not keeping him incarcerated after they arrested him for drug possession. He offered, "I never would have killed anyone if they sent me to jail. If they don't punish you for breaking the law, well, what were they doing, waiting until I broke a big law so they could put me in prison all my life?" Herbert, under cross-examination, admitted that he could and did disobey commands to kill. He had received telepathic commands to commit suicide, but refused. Prosecutor Chris Cottle, temporarily filling in for DDA Chang, stated, "If he, Herbert, was the victim of irresistible voices, he, Herbert, would have killed himself." Herbert countered with, "I received a message in December I didn't act on. I just didn't want to kill anymore. I just didn't think it was right." Without understanding it, Herbert had just provided a statement absolutely crucial to the prosecution's case because he'd admitted knowing the difference between right and wrong. The prosecution followed Herbert's statement and declared Herbert was not his father's robot, powerless to disobey, as he had previously stated. Herbert had demonstrated he was capable of selectively obeying his father's messages to kill. When he heard his father tell him to kill his uncle Enos, he refused, and the voice then suggested an alternative victim. Without a doubt, Herbert taking the stand completely destroyed any chance his attorney had of convincing the jury that his client was insane, and therefore could not be found guilty of these murders. Chapter 11. Santa Cruz County Superior Court, August 1973. Herbert Mullen's case rests with the jury. The prosecution's case continued on a roll after the debacle that resulted when Herbert took the stand. Bob Francis became a witness for the prosecution. He testified that Herbert used LSD in large quantities very often. After making the statement, Herbert nodded, which marked the first time he showed any interest in what the witnesses said in his murder trial. Some people took the nod as Herbert rationalizing the need to kill James Gianera based on what Bob had just shared with the court. Joan Gianera's mother also testified regarding the gruesome discovery she made. Ballistics experts and medical examiners were then brought in to testify. They talked about how Herbert violently overkilled his victims, how he stabbed them numerous times when they were already dead. As they testified, Herbert scribbled down copious notes. On August 4, 1973, the defense brought in their star witness, Dr. Donald Lund. Lund explained that he clinically diagnosed Herbert with paranoid schizophrenia. He played a cassette depicting one of his interviews with Herbert to the court. The following was Herbert's philosophy about life. "You see, the thing is, people get together, say, in the White House. People like to sing the die song. You know, people like to sing the die song. If I'm president of my class when I graduate from high school, I can tell two, possibly three young male homo sapiens to die. I can sing that song to them and they'll have to kill themselves or be killed in an automobile accident, a knifing, a gunshot wound. You ask me why this is, and I say, well, they have to do that in order to protect the ground from an earthquake because all the other people in my community have been dying all year long. In my class, we have to chip in, so to speak, to the darkness. We have to die also, and people would rather sing the die song than murder. I believe man has believed in reincarnation for maybe consciously, verbally for 10,000 years. And so they instituted this law. They used to do it back then, 10,000 years ago. Well, they let a guy go kill crazy, you know. He'd go kill crazy maybe 20 or 30 people. Then they'd lynch him, you know, or they'd have another kill crazy person kill him. Because they don't want him to get too powerful in the next life, you know. Lund said in court that Herbert told him that if he, Lund, prepared a chronology of the world's wars and famines and compared it with a list of major earthquakes throughout history, he, Lund, would see that when the death rate goes up, the number of earthquakes goes down. Both the prosecution and defense looked at William Martin Mullen, Herbert's father, as a reason behind the murders, but with serious differences in the level of responsibility. The prosecution blamed Herbert's intense hatred of his father, while Herbert blamed his father directly for the murders. Herbert believed his father was a murderer, not himself. He said his father telepathically issued kill commands. William Mullen, a Marine and proud of his World War II service, taught Herbert that violence was natural. The man also taught Herbert how to shoot a gun with the aim of a marksman. We likely will not know the influence that William Mullen had over Herbert. The prosecution felt compelled to advise the court that it was not illegal for Mr. Mullen to share war stories with Herbert or to teach him how to handle a gun. DDA Chang took it a step further and said Mr. Mullen might have been trying to engage with Herbert in the events in his life that rendered the most meaning. Defense Attorney Jackson countered that his client felt his father challenged him often, and he had to kill people to answer his father's challenge. Working toward establishing that Herbert knew what he had done was wrong, the prosecution discussed the various measures he took to cover his killings. The prosecution noted that Herbert had sandpapered bloodstains off his bat after killing Lawrence White. The jury was told how Herbert collected shell casings from the murder scene at the Gianera home. Herbert had shot and killed Kathy and her kids because they were witnesses, and he filed off the serial number of his gun. Assistant DDA Cottle went down the line of things the defendant had done to cover up his killings, all the while Herbert glared at him. This part of the testimony got Herbert to once again show emotion, a rarity in this trial. The evidence presented, however, damaged the line of thought Mr. Jackson tried to portray his client as being insane. Needless to say, the prosecution kept hammering the defense with more evidence. In an earlier interview, Herbert said he killed Joan Gianera because she was a witness and I didn't want to be punished. This furthered the prosecution's contention that Herbert Mullen knew his actions were very wrong. Herbert killed James Gianera for getting him into drugs, and Joan, Kathy, Damon, and David because they were witnesses. He said he killed the campers because I have a thing about hippies. Prosecutors focused on Herbert's claim that he heard his victims telepathically agree to be killed. Dr. Morris said Herbert's statement was a concocted rationalization. He developed this belief as an afterthought, said Morris. He's an individual with a high mental capacity and an interest in the occult, psychology, and philosophy. Three further arguments were brought by the defense attorney Jackson. Some said he'd been grasping at straws since the beginning, but now his credibility as an attorney was being questioned. First, he brought up what Herbert told him he called the Jonah theory. Herbert felt the duty of sacrificing yourself or others by murder for the sake of the community best demonstrated his sick interpretation of Jonah. Herbert stated, "The 13th man must be a scapegoat and sacrifice himself for the others." He followed with, "I mean, you read in the Bible about Jonah, when there were 12 men in that boat. Jonah was in the boat, you know. It was just like Jesus, you know, and Jonah stood up and said, 'God darn, if somebody doesn't die, you know all 13 of us are gonna die.' And he jumped overboard, you know, and he was drowned, you know. And the sea, I mean, about in a half an hour or so, it calmed down." When Dr. Lund testified that Jonah was pushed and didn't die after all because he was spit up by the whale, Herbert grew defensive and yelled, "I'm asking you to swallow this Jonah story and believe that a minor natural disaster will prevent a major natural disaster." Mr. Jackson followed with another theory as to Herbert's insanity, that of killing people to prevent earthquakes. Some suggested, including DDA Chang, that Herbert came up with this reason after he'd been arrested, and not before. In Dr. Lund's opinion, however, Herbert devised this theory years earlier, citing Herbert's numerous letters he'd written to the UN and other organizations, requesting statistics on yearly death tolls and natural disasters. Among Herbert's personal notes in his apartment were his unbelievable theories pertaining to earthquakes. Since he'd been born on April 18th, the anniversary of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, he believed he had a privileged position among his generation to save it from future earthquakes. And Albert Einstein died on April 18th, which proved, at least to Herbert, that Einstein sacrificed himself so that he, Herbert, would not have to be killed in Vietnam, but could save the coast from earthquakes instead. Lastly, the defense argued a conspiracy Herbert called repressed sexuality. Herbert believed his family tried to hide the healthiness of bisexuality from him. And based on his own research, Herbert stated the majority of people who are homosexual began feeling as though they were homosexual around the age of 8 years old. He felt his parents were obligated to let him know this and did everything they could to keep him from learning about it. Herbert said everyone in his family practiced homosexuality. He wrote in one of his doctrines that his parents and sister, as well as his aunt and uncle, Bernice and Enos, plotted against him in an effort to prevent him from experiencing his own sexuality. Herbert wrote, When I was 5 years old, I feel intuitively that Bernice and Enos, for rot, talked my parents into ignoring me. My parents actually did not tell me the necessary facts of life, sex and death rate, social conversation techniques, etc. Bernice and Enos, they didn't have any children. What did Bernice and Enos convince my parents that I should be shunned? Well, my guess is that my cousins and sister were having orgasms at age 6. When I was 5, Bernice and Enos wanted to stop my mental and physical growth. They did not want me to mature. Naturally, the judge, jury, and everyone in the courtroom grew tired of Herbert's accusations and the defense's repeated attempts, however bizarre, discussed in court in an effort to make the jury believe Herbert to be insane. Once this last-ditch effort came to an end, the prosecution rested its case. The defense had no more people available to testify that might convince the jury that Herbert killed because of insanity. Therefore, the defense concurred that closing statements should be heard. Closing arguments only lasted a few hours. Mr. Jackson asked the jury to honestly consider his opinion that Herbert killed because he has to, but he doesn't know why. I suggest that a person who kills 13 people and doesn't know why is mad. Deputy District Attorney Chang added in his closing argument, well, there's no question he's, Herbert Mullen, mentally ill. I mean, seriously mentally ill. But that does not mean he's legally insane. DDA Chang briefly revisited the fact that Herbert tried to hide his crimes, including grinding the serial numbers off his handgun. Finally, what everyone assumed would be a short trial came to an end. The jury, made up of 6 men and 6 women, deliberated for 14 hours once the judge gave them the jury instructions. On August 19, 1973, everyone returned to court to hear the jury's verdict. The jury found Herbert Mullen guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, Jim Gianera and Kathy Francis, and found him guilty of 8 counts of second-degree murder because they felt the remaining murders were done on impulse and were not premeditated. This ruling did not sit well with the families of the victims. However, the judge immediately sentenced Herbert to life in prison without the possibility of parole until 2020. Therefore, it required 5 months to convict a serial killer after the serial killer admitted on the first day of trial that he killed over and over until growing tired and finally giving up. Within a week of the guilty verdicts, Herbert Mullen packed his mountain of court notes and scribbles he jotted during his time in custody because he'd be transported to prison in the morning. Early the next day, Herbert Mullen, belly-chained and smiling, headed to California Men's Colony State Prison in San Luis Obispo. At the time, he showed no remorse and said he looked forward to what prison had to offer him. He also said he could not wait to get away from Edmund Kemper. It should be noted that the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office did finally charge Herbert with Father Andre Tomei's murder. However, on December 11, 1973, when the trial was set to begin, Herbert pleaded guilty to second-degree murder after originally pleading not guilty by reason of insanity to first-degree murder. In 1993, Herbert transferred from California Men's Colony State Prison to Mule Creek in Ione, California, where he remains today. Chapter 12. Herbert Mullen left the Santa Cruz area, and Edmund Kemper was found guilty and also sent away. Finally, the people, especially young women, in the Santa Cruz area began to feel slightly safer. Overall, residents were happy that Herbert was found criminally sane and guilty of 10 murders. But there were more than a few who felt he truly was insane and should have been placed in a locked state mental health facility. The fact the other 3 murders were never charged against him still bothered residents for many years. The effort and determination required by law enforcement and the prosecution to successfully convince the judge and the jury that Herbert Mullen was sane and competent to stand trial should not be overlooked. In the early 1970s, when schizophrenia really began to get diagnosed and treated, many other people diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia committed various types of crimes in varying degrees of severity, but never stood trial. These folks ended up in state mental hospitals and lived like caged zombies, constantly over-medicated and locked in facilities for years at a time. These individuals are the same people Ronald Reagan put back on the streets when he closed the majority of state hospitals servicing clients with severe mental health issues. Mental health issues are experienced by a large portion of our population, and unless those experiencing these problems have a lot of money, or their families have a lot of money, they rarely can afford the intensive treatment and medications they need to function day to day. This has been a problem society, law enforcement, and the courts have known for quite some time. As a law enforcement member, I've contacted numerous people who suffer from paranoid schizophrenia. They live on the streets, scavenge for their next meal, and sometimes, when the voices in their head get real bad, they act out. The majority of these people do not wish to harm others. If they could get the voices in their heads to stop, they'd gladly do it. Only now, in 2015, are law enforcement members getting spot-on training to deal with people suffering from mental health issues. And more affordable programs are being developed to get folks help. However, the process is extremely slow. The Mullins family had a front-row seat to dealing and living with someone who suffers from schizophrenia. Mr. Mullen attended all of his son's court dates, but did not talk to newspapers or reporters about his family's ordeal. Mrs. Mullen attended once but could not bear to see her son in the condition he was in and never came back to court. Many years later, the Mullins both passed away with their son still in prison and still denying his role in the murders of 13 people. I never spoke to them for this case, but I've talked to numerous parents whose children suffer from schizophrenia. Almost all of them believe their children's illness somehow resulted from something they did while raising their children. These parents never forgave themselves when their children acted out or ended up in custody. The overwhelming grief of your own child being accused of several murders had to have been completely terrible for the Mullins family. They knew Herbert had issues and tried to help, but he'd fallen too far, and sadly, he could not be saved. The rest of the families and friends of the victims did as most do. They moved on slowly as time went by. To this day, the community is tight-knit, and very few who live there even know about the murderous rampage Herbert Mullen had gone on. Herbert had originally been sentenced to life without parole until 2020. Since that time, many laws and regulations changed in California after his guilty verdict, making him eligible for a parole review hearing in 2006. On March 23, 2006, Herbert spoke to the review board and shared some of his thoughts. He told them he wished to move to Boulder Creek and planned to find a wife. He said he'd be a hard-working, law-abiding citizen. On the surface, Herbert appeared as though he'd rehearsed his presentation 100 times. He was polite and communicated well. But the California Board of Prison Terms refused to release him. They suggested he remain in custody for at least 5 more years, which is the maximum time allowed between review hearings. The panel's hearing lasted almost 2 hours with Herbert, during which Herbert admitted his guilt. He also shared with the panel how his life was in prison, and he told them lengthy plans he had if he were released. "I just want to get back to living my life free," Herbert told the panel of two commissioners. Their identities are confidential under California prison rules. "This is ugly. These are very ugly crimes you've been convicted of," a commissioner replied to Herbert. As the commissioner recited the names of his victims and the circumstances of their deaths, Herbert remained calm. He lifted his head a few times and rolled his eyes once. It appeared hearing the names of the people he killed wore on him negatively. After this point, he became argumentative, but quickly regained his composure. "The people I'm accused of killing, I did kill," Herbert said after the commissioner finished, "but I'm not guilty by reason of insanity." Herbert, aged 26 when he arrived in prison, is now 68 years old, is a slight man, tiny compared to the correctional officers who guard him. He's also balding and wears large wire-rimmed glasses. During the hearing, Herbert changed his reason for the killings. He explained that at the time he suffered from undifferentiated schizophrenia. "I was not a thinking individual," he said, blaming his parents for denying him maturity and not teaching me the facts of life. He added that his parents didn't explain the pecking order to him, and that he's had to learn about the system of deference to those in power while in prison. "The state should be punishing my parents, at least chastising them publicly," Herbert told the panel, beginning to feel whatever he said would not persuade them to release him early. "They're the ones who made me do it. They put me in a situation where I became mentally insane." Herbert also told the panel that he attends Alcoholics Anonymous meetings regularly and does not, and has not, taken any medication since 1976. He shared that he's completed courses in cabinetry, landscaping, cooking, and study Tai Chi. A prison report provided to the panel by Herbert stated he'd been a janitor for the past 5 years and received positive evaluations from his supervisor. Herbert said based on the classes he'd taken while in prison, he thought he could be a gas station attendant or grocery clerk if released. One of the commissioners told Herbert that the world had changed significantly since he'd been arrested and that most gas stations were self-serve these days. Herbert did not waver and pleaded with the panel that he'd changed and he felt he could return to society and be productive. "I'm extremely remorseful and sorrowful for my part in committing this crime," Herbert stated with conviction. "I pray for the souls of the victims every day." However, Santa Cruz County Prosecutor Ariadne Simmons, who'd been sitting a few paces from Herbert during the hearing, finally spoke and said, "His disregard for human suffering was astonishing." She also pointed out that Herbert provided no statement to the families of his victims. As to his plan to seek shelter and help finding a job at New Life Community Services in Santa Cruz, Simmons said it's doubtful he could find such a place. She explained that she serves on the agency's board, and those who seek help there must accept responsibility for their actions, something Herbert refused to do when he had been convicted, and even during the review hearing many years later. "I don't care how well he behaves in prison," Simmons stated. "Prison is also about retribution. He spent 32 years in prison, and he hasn't begun to pay his debt to society, not only for the 13 people he killed, but also for the families, the loved ones in this community." Parole for Herbert, as mentioned above, was denied based on the cruel and callous manner in which he'd murdered 13 people, the fact he still had not admitted or accepted his responsibility for the murders, and the panel felt he posed a significant continuing danger to society. When Herbert heard the decision, he rolled his eyes in disgust. One of the panel members felt the need to reiterate their ruling and said, "You are not the victim here. The victims and the families are the victims. You are the individual that made them victims." And with that, the hearing ended. Chapter 13, Conclusion. Serial killer Herbert Mullen's life is difficult to comprehend, because we know he was born into a loving family, and there's never been an allegation, even from Herbert when he truly hated his father, that Herbert was ever physically or emotionally abused as a child or during his adolescence. From everything I've read and researched, Herbert lived a normal childhood, yet, obviously, much more existed to Herbert Mullen than anyone knew or could have expected. Unlike most serial killers, Herbert truly had no specific victim typology. He killed whoever the voices told him to kill, and whoever became a potential witness to his murders. He had a strong disconnect with his father, yet most serial killers tend to have issues with their mother. Instead of killing people in one specific manner, Herbert used bats, guns, and a knife. These facts alone make him unique as a serial killer, but the results were the same as with all the other serial killers. Innocent people were murdered. When his closest friend, Dean Robertson, died in a car crash, Herbert, an outgoing guy, became reserved. This specific event ruptured Herbert's ability to think rationally. Soon after Dean's death, evil and menacing voices chattered in Herbert's head every moment of every day. He'd later attest to the fact that the voices dominated his thoughts. He built many shrines to Dean in his bedroom and sat there looking at them for hours on end. Around the same time, Herbert began to experiment with LSD, a serious hallucinogenic narcotic. The dangerous and volatile narcotic, mixed with the untimely death of Dean Robertson, unlocked a powerful form of schizophrenia previously dormant within Herbert Mullen that drove him to become one of California's worst serial killers. You've read what happened as a result of Herbert's life path after being diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and we know he was found guilty of 10 murders. The court proceedings for multiple murders were relatively quick, and within a few days of the guilty verdict, he was shipped off to prison. His life, once inside the prison system, became almost as mundane and uneventful as his childhood. The Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office charged him with Father Tomei's murder. He pled guilty to second-degree murder without a long or strenuous hearing process. Herbert later confessed to the murders of Lawrence White and Mary Guilfoyle. However, at the time of this writing, he's not been charged with their murders. In 1983, Herbert was caught in a sexual act with another male inmate, forcing his housing unit to be changed. Sexual acts of all sorts occur in prison. Most men who are housed in prison are not homosexual. However, they will experiment from time to time with members of the same sex, but only while in custody. In 1986, during a routine cell search, Herbert was found to be in possession of bird feathers, bird wings, and X-Acto knives. He claimed that the items were for religious ceremonies, but could not offer which religious group they were for. He received a write-up for the infraction and hasn't received a write-up since then. Currently, Herbert is on a special needs yard for protective custody at Mule Creek Prison. His prison rating level is a 2, which is considered to be very low security. He achieved this status because, beyond a few isolated incidents over a long period of time, Herbert Mullen tends to keep to himself and does not present problems for prison staff. In 2008, Herbert got into an argument with another inmate. During the argument, the other man punched Herbert one time in the head. The parties were separated. Herbert received an ice pack for the small abrasion on his head, and the ordeal ended as quickly as it began. Herbert hasn't had any other prison activity of note since then. Today, he works for janitorial services and continues to get great evaluations from prison staff. February 17, 2021 marks the next time Herbert will be eligible for another parole hearing. He'll be 73 years old. Until he accepts what he's done and acknowledges all of the lives he ruined due to his stubbornness, I don't think he'll be paroled. His inability to trust others, medical staff, and willingness to blame others for his own actions make it highly unlikely a review board would release him back into society. One of the primary roles of the parole hearing is to determine whether or not the subject takes ownership for their actions and has been successfully rehabilitated as to be very likely to reoffend. I don't feel Herbert has made such improvements in his life during his life sentence. Society has undergone major changes since 1973, and although Herbert expresses a desire to find a job, get a place to stay, and start his own family, all things I believe he feels the parole board wants to hear him say, we must consider one very simple question. If he gets out, how long until the voices in his head convince him to murder again? About the author. Chris Swinney is a police officer in the San Francisco Bay Area. His writing includes the best-selling Bill Dix Detective Series, which he based the books on his experience as a cop. Swinney has written 3 other true crime books: Robert Picton, The Pig Farmer Killer, The Killer Handyman, The True Story of William Patrick Fife, Robert Black, The True Story of a Child Rapist and Serial Killer in the UK. Chris is a big-time supporter of teachers, parents, law enforcement, doctors, nurses, firefighters, American troops, juvenile diabetes research, and children. He spends time volunteering for his church, at schools, he coaches, and every once in a while, he gets to go fly fishing. True Crime by Chris Swinney. Number 1 bestseller on Amazon, the US, UK, Canada, and Australia. Released 10/26/2015. Robert Black, The True Story of a Child Rapist and Serial Killer. Given up for adoption by his mother at only a few weeks old, Robert Black is placed with physically abusive foster parents, setting the tone for who and what he'd become: a pedophile and serial killer. Starting at the age of 5, He recalls being sexually curious and began placing items in his anus at the age of 8. He'd sexually assault hundreds of little girls before committing his first murder. Sadly, as law enforcement stumbled along with no leads or evidence, Robert Black would strike repeatedly, destroying families and preying on innocent little girls in the United Kingdom. Number one bestseller on Amazon in the U.S., U.K., and Canada. Released 9/25/2015. The Killer Handyman, William Patrick Fife. A harmless-looking man moved to Montreal looking for a new start and to get off drugs. Somewhere along the line, his urge to prey on unsuspecting women, something he'd done and kept a secret for 20 years, became too much to keep inside. William Fife, a.k.a. the Killer Handyman, snapped, leaving at least 9 women brutally beaten, murdered, and sexually abused post-mortem. If not for the diligent work of a criminal forensic specialist and her discovery of a single fingerprint, Fife may have continued to kill at will, keeping Montreal residents, particularly single middle-aged women, frightened and sequestered in their own homes. Number one bestseller on Amazon in the U.S., U.K., and Canada. Released 3/1/2015. Robert Picton, the Pig Farmer Killer. Robert Picton inherited a pig farm worth $1 million and used his wealth to lure Skid Row hookers to his farm, where he confessed to murdering 49 female victims, dismembering and feeding their body parts to his pigs, which he supplied to Vancouver area restaurants. Acknowledgements. Complex serial killer investigations normally consume an investigator's thoughts and push entire agencies close to the brink of cracking as they try to bring closure to grieving families, satisfying the public's demand for answers, and capturing or eliminating the killer. Securing the minute details of what a serial killer did, why they did it, and what might have led them to become a monster several decades later poses a significant challenge. Therefore, I'd like to thank the following people, associations, and groups for assisting me with the collection of such facts for this book. None of my work is possible without supreme effort from others, and I thank all of you dearly. Stay frosty, and don't become complacent. To my readers, I appreciate you, and thank you. Law Enforcement. Salinas Police Department. Santa Cruz Police Department. Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office. Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office. Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office. Santa Cruz County District Attorney's Office. Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office. Santa Cruz County Prosecutor, Ariadne Simon. Santa Cruz County Prosecutor, Peter Chang. James Jackson, Herbert Mullen's attorney. Detective Terry Medina, later a police chief, retired. Acquaintances. Dr. Donald Lund. Dr. Charles Morris. Dr. Joseph Middleton. Bob Francis. Ed Lawrence. Pat Brown. Alan Hansen. Research. Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office Police Reports. Santa Cruz Police Department Police Reports. San Jose Police Department Police Reports. Los Gatos Police Department Police Reports. San Francisco County Sheriff's Office Police Reports. Donald Lund, psychiatrist who interviewed Herbert. California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation Review Reports. San Francisco Chronicle. New York Times. Santa Cruz Public Library. Santa Cruz Sentinel. Merced, Sunstar. True TV, Crime Library. Wikipedia.com. Murderpedia.com. CrimeLibrary.com. The victims. Lawrence White, 55. Mary Guilfoyle, 24. Father Henri Thome, 64. James Gianera, 24. Joan Gianera, 23. Kathleen Prentice, a.k.a. Kathy Francis, 30. David Hughes, 9. Damon Francis, 4. Robert Spector, 18. David Oliker, 18. Brian Scott Card, 19. Mark Dre Belbus, 19. Fred Perez, 72. This has been Deadly Voices, the true story of serial killer Herbert Mullen, written by C.L. Swinney, R.J. Parker, narrated by Don Klein. Copyright 2015 by R.J. Parker Publishing. Production copyright 2016 by R.J. Parker Publishing.